All right, so we're ready to get started. Yes, no, ready? Okay. So design for scalability. What I mean by this is these are really, really kind of large problems, and what you want is solutions which are realistically applicable to the problem as a whole. You don't want to solve it for just one little corner or for one specific sub-problem. You want to produce something which is credibly a solution for the entire mess, right? Could you just check, is that camera actually catching the whole screen?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll give you an example of this, which is the tent, right? The tent is not a great solution in some ways. It doesn't last very long in the sun. That's its main problem. But at the end of the day, tents are workable in almost every situation. And we use an enormous number of them for all kinds of situations. And a tent is a scalable solution. It kind of works. A solution that turned out not to be scalable is the geodesic dome.
What?
Geodesic domes, you know, Buckminster Fuller?
Yeah, okay.
Right? It looks fine on paper. In practice, it turns out not to be scalable because they're just too freaking difficult to produce. Right? And they're really, really, it's a bunch of math, and if you get your pieces slightly wrong, they don't fit, and if they don't fit, there's really no way of understanding why. They're very difficult to waterproof. I mean, there's a bunch of practical problems with domes. Tents are scalable. Domes turn out not to be yet. Maybe you need CAD/CAM manufacturing, maybe you need new materials technology, maybe there's some trick that we missed. But the dome is not scalable in the same way. Other examples of things which are genuinely scalable: Coca-Cola, cell phones, Land Rovers, television, radio, refined sugar, caffeine. Right? These are things that were not globally available, but it turns out that people like them so much they will pay to have them available almost anywhere in the world. Right? And you can get a carburetor for a Land Rover within 100 miles of just about anywhere on the planet. And there's a reason for that. The Land Rover really, really, really works. So scalability is about producing things that can be used on a very broad scale that solve fundamental problems, and ideally that people are willing to pay for, at least to the point where their willingness to pay matches the cost of providing the product or service. This all kind of makes sense? Now, to get to that point, it's a combination of skill and luck, and frankly, most of it is luck. You know, if you looked at 100 products, it would have been very hard to predict that the cell phone would go everywhere, but say the transistor radio wouldn't, because there are now far more cell phones than transistor radios, but it's way more expensive, and you need this grid, and it costs money, and, you know, it's hard to predict what will and won't work. That doesn't mean we don't try, it just means you try a bunch of stuff, and you see what succeeds in the marketplace. And I don't necessarily mean the commercial marketplace. There are lots of definitions of the marketplace. It comes down to you see what people like. But as always, there are some actual, you know, scalability metrics, right? So if we run over this list, strictest definition for refugees, 9 million people. 9 million people is about the size of Sweden, yeah? A little more? That's about the strictest definition. If you expand that to other definitions, there are other parts of the UN that would say it's closer to 30 to 60 million, and by the time you include internally displaced people, questionable situations like Gaza, by the time you stack all of these people up and you add the Iraq war numbers and all the rest of it, you get much, much larger numbers. This is beginning to be, you know, a pretty sizable percentage of the population of Europe. It's about the size of Britain. Typical stays decades in camps. So wherever you're going to produce we probably don't need a replacement for the tent because the tent lasts fairly well for a year and kind of sort of works. Improved tents, maybe. There might be some room for an improved tent, but kind of the tent thing is done. But long stay stuff, very important. Consumption of disaster relief tents, according to the NRC, 6 to 40 million tents a unit a year. So a typical tent is about $300 to $350. We'll call it $300. So 6 by 300, $180 million of tents in a slow year, something like $1 billion of tents in a big year. So there's really a ton of money going through this disaster relief tent industry, all of which is potentially money that could be funding new solutions. And if you came up with a solution that was significantly cheaper to implement, there's a pile of money to be made there, which pays for scaling the solution globally. It's not that there isn't enough money to actually approach this. Somebody's spending a ton of money on tents. 100 million homeless globally, I think that's actually kind of an underestimate. I have no idea how that number was prepared. It looks low to me. Billion, but it is an official number from, I can't remember which UN body, one of them. I have references, I can't dig them out if anybody wants to know. Billion plus very poor people, that's the dollar a day and less community. You know, when you really begin to look at what it takes to rebuild after disasters, these folks are living in essentially a permanent state of disaster. It's not that everything they own was destroyed by a tsunami, it's that everything that they owned never existed because it was destroyed by the way their economy functions. They never had anything, they never have. And this last thing, continuum of shelter solutions. You know, from mild climates where people are only going to be outdoor for a few weeks, all the way through to awful mountain conditions with tons of snow where people are going to be for, you know, 20 years. There's a huge range of solutions there. It'd be very nice if we could find something that worked in the worst cases, but even if we get a real breakthrough in the easy cases, that's still real progress. Let's see if we're right. Okay. Does this kind of make sense? Right, it's a continuum of problems. And you can get some of the easier cases and then work out from there. And that's a process. Okay, scalability factors. If it costs an additional pound per shelter, an additional dollar per shelter, an additional euro per shelter, by the time you look at 6 to 40 million shelters a year, that turns into a lot of money. So every dollar that you can save on the shelter design is useful. Logistics, NGOs want it small and light. NGOs are very, very attached to this idea of you load your stuff into a plane and you fly it there. Practically speaking, I think that's one of the biggest areas for innovation, because in a lot of the world, if you can manufacture it locally in a big industrial city, you can drive it by truck rather than fly. And once you talk about driving things in a truck, it's a whole different ballgame. Yes, sir?
Yeah, just sort of relating to what you're saying, when we had rescue agency here, mm-hmm. A little more than a year ago, they said that it would be preferable that these solutions could be produced locally. Mm-hmm. As much as possible, it can be produced locally, the better it is, or near, as close as possible. So.
Good. Because, I mean, I do feel that there's enough industrial capacity in India, in Africa, in South America, to do a lot of this stuff. And that doesn't mean you can get to everywhere. I mean, there are certainly some situations where you're going to wind up flying in shelters regardless of what you do, because the area is pretty much inaccessible, or it's 500 miles from the nearest thing that looks like an industrial center, 1,000 miles. But in a lot of cases, I mean, South Africa's got heavy industrial production capability, and there's reasonable road access to a pretty good chunk of Africa. If you could manufacture what you need for disasters in South Africa rather than making it in Pakistan and flying it, that's clearly a win. So material supply chain. Graham Saunders, who's one of the IFRC guys, International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent guys, talking about shelter, says that for real production use, for actual technologies that they're going to standardize on using, about their minimum buy is 100,000 units. And it turns out that getting 100,000 units of pretty much anything produced is a big problem. Because if you work with some kind of exotic material and you go back to them and say, look, what we'd like to buy is 100,000 units, they're going to come back and say, that's 5 years of our global production. And then you say, and worse, it's spike production. So we don't need 100,000 units every year. What we need is 100,000 units, and then they're going to go and field test those. And then they're going to come back in 2 more years, and then they might want 500,000, or they might not want any more. So it's extremely uneven production. What that means is that when you consider the materials that you want to use, you want to look for materials that are already in colossal global production. You want to pick stuff which is really, really common and produced in vast quantities, so that you're pulling off an existing material supply chain. You don't want to have to finance the capital investment for new factories to produce complicated new materials. You don't want to take a material that exists that isn't used very widely and then say, well, here's our shelter using it, because the odds are that financing the scale up of those factories is going to be extremely difficult inside of this model, because the production is just, it's really, really, really unpredictable. Sometimes they want lots, sometimes they don't want any, sometimes there are lots of disasters, sometimes there are none. So as far as possible, think about light things that require very little capital to mass produce, because most of the stuff that's in that system is already being used a lot. Does that kind of make sense? I mean, this is fairly sort of technical stuff, but as designers, it's worth understanding. Yes?
Yeah, I was thinking, when you're talking about local products and manufacturing locally, I suppose you're talking about when the shelters are upgraded and not the first send out, because you don't know perhaps what can be reached for in 1 week, or so it takes a little time to figure out what you can get from that country or to get from places that are pretty close. And so this is more, what you're talking about isn't the first delivery, it's deliveries.
Oh,
that's
no,
come
I'm talking
later
about
on.
I'm talking about the first delivery.
But how can you know what you can find in 2 days in that particular country?
Well,
and make
just,
something out of it.
There just aren't that many countries. What we need is a global map. We need somebody to get, you know, years worth of funding to basically work their way around the embassies of damn near every country on Earth and say, what are your industrial centers produce in terms of materials?
But then you are to manufacture it when you need it and not have it stored. So how can you manufacture a lot of things like in such short a time?
Well,
in 2 days.
Here's the production process for a hexier. You take a plywood sheet, 4 feet by 8 feet, which is the standard size. You use whole sheets for the walls, and for the roof, you cut the sheet in half from one corner to the other corner, either using a manual saw or using a power saw. Then you put it together with a screw gun.
Okay, so because that leads me to another question I was thinking about. The thing about the hexayoke, because I haven't really understood what is the benefits with that particular design. Why is it a hexayoke versus a square or anything else, and what it's made of, and how do you build it to make it this sufficient as you described it?
Sure. Well, I'll give you the nutshell answer, right? And I don't want you guys to walk onto this as the perfect shelter, right? What I want to explain is the process by which it came into existence. So the question was, how do you make an extremely manufacturable geodesic dome? You know, I was working on geodesic domes off and on since the mid-1990s. I did a whole bunch of math that turned out to be very useful to a lot of people. You know, corrected printing errors in Buckminster Fuller's patents. You know, I mean, I was dome guy. But at the end of the day, it turns out the geodesic domes just, they suck to manufacture. You can't get below about 25% wastage from standard material sizes. So in the process of simplifying the geodesic dome, I came up with this shape, the hexier. And I said, oh, that's kind of interesting. Maybe somebody would have a use for that. But I didn't really have an application in mind until there was a design competition, a design meeting at the Rocky Mountain Institute that specifically talked about a new generation of disaster response. And one of the things they said was, it'd be really great if we had a shelter that you could put up in the field, and when you were done, you could fold it up again, move it on a truck and unfold it. Because then you could take refugee camps, and you could have all of the people in the refugee camp, and when the time came to resettle them, you could put their shelters on a truck, village by village, drive the truck to the village, unload the shelters, and then the villagers could walk, and it would take them 5 or 6 days to get home, but then they could put the shelters back up again. And I said, well, that's really interesting. I happen to know that this thing will fold. Here's the folding hexier design. How does that solve the problem? And everybody went, ooh, this is very clever. So that was the design specification. It was designed as a shelter that would be mobile.
What do you mean by foldable? Because if it's made of plywood, I don't really
okay.
see the foldability.
That's absolutely correct. I'll show you what I mean by fold. Give me just one second here. Sorry. Here we are. So this is one kind of folding hex here, and this is the very small size. You see, it just pops out.
But what is it that's made out of paper, cardboard?
Well, this one is definitely not plywood, right?
No.
But you
so
can.
So is that usable in a real environment, or that's just for showing?
That's an idea. That's an excellent question. When we first developed that model, the understanding was that we were operating off was this idea that we were going to mass manufacture these things and then stockpile them.
Mm.
And that was a very, that seemed like a reasonable idea. But then we actually looked at the situation in more detail, and it began to be apparent that we needed a different approach. And I'm trying to find... So there's this question about whether you stockpile or whether you manufacture locally.
Right.
And this is a demonstration I did for the Netherlands Red Cross in Eindhoven. So whether you stockpile or whether you manufacture locally comes down to economics. So in an African setting where you're dealing with refugee camps, it might make sense to manufacture these things ahead of time. And then the next year, when you're going to go take out the next round of tents for the refugees, you take out these instead of another round of tents. Because you've got a year's lead time. You know that you're going to be replacing the shelters for that population, so you take them out a different shelter. Then the next year, you don't take them out a new shelter. On the other hand, if you're dealing with something like flooding in Bangladesh, every 3 or 4 years, suddenly you've got 3 million people homeless. And in that situation, you're not going to mess around with all this folding stuff. You're going to make something that's quick and efficient and dirty and cheap and just works. And it just so happens that you've got the same basic geometry that can be made as an expensive folding unit that you stockpile or a cheap unit that you put together with screw guns. The fact is that the hexer is only a shape. There are radically different manufacturing technologies
okay.
that come off that.
That was kind of what I was fishing
yeah.
for here.
Exactly.
What
right.
what's the thing about
it? It's an observation, right? I mean, the simple truth of it, right? Is the hexier is defined by the fact that that's half of a standard industrial panel. That's all a hexier is. It's a building you make with standard size industrial panel materials.
Mm-hmm.
And you can adjust it a little if you've got non-standard material sizes like we have here. There's really nothing clever about it, right? It's not, why it wasn't invented 50 years ago, I have no idea. But because it works with standard industrial sized pieces, it makes it very, very easy for you to go out there and produce enormous scale without having to have heavy investment in infrastructure. So it's kind of a sweet spot. You can make it with a whole bunch of different materials, you can make it with a whole bunch of different properties, you can make it in enormous volumes from existing stuff, and it's not so difficult to make that you can't train builders to make it. Right? Very, very simple. The basic recipe of cut six of the boards in half and screw them together, Bob, is something that you can easily imagine becoming an indigenous capability. Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, it was just that I can understand the benefits when it's foldable, that you have some kind of system so you can just fold it out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are making it out of other materials and they are producing it locally, then I don't understand the benefits of the shape of it. Then it could
okay.
be whatever shape. Or what's the... Why is it a hexagon?
Okay.
Like,
so it's six sides, because if it's seven sides, the roof doesn't have any point.
Okay.
Right?
But where's it square, for example? Normal houses are usually square.
If it's square, it uses almost twice as much material for every square foot of area inside of it.
Okay.
The closer you get to a hemisphere, the more efficient your use of surface is.
Okay.
So six sides gives you a pretty good compromise, right, between material use and roof slope.
Okay.
If you're building it in a snow area, you might do five sides or even four sides to give you a roof that had enough point that snow would come off of it.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, I mean, it's a guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've prototyped these things, we've tested them extensively in America, they seem to work great. We've got a whole bunch of folks who are very interested in the idea, but there's no commercial production version and there's no official field test.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that I've described about lack of money to do innovation in the NGO world comes from years of saying, look, we have this technology, it's free, anybody can use it, anybody can manufacture, anybody can test. Are you guys interested in doing that? And having NGOs say, oh, this is really, really interesting, when you have some test data, let us know. Oh, well, do you want to help us get some test data? No, we have no funds to do that. Well, how did you think this was going to happen? You know, there's no model of partnership between the NGOs and the individual to try and develop new technologies. And this is part of what's so exciting about the involvement of the Swedish Rescue Agency, that you've actually got a situation where an NGO is coming and saying, we're open to new ideas, what do you have? And that happens very rarely, and it's very important to work with them closely when the opportunity exists. So yeah, you can see, ta-da! I actually made that building, I cut the panels and put them together in the way that the fold does on my own earlier that day. So it took me about 4 or 5 hours of hard work, which is difficult because the panels are quite large for one person to move around and hold in position to tape. So it took me about 4 or 5 hours on my own to assemble the building, and then we could put it up in about 15 minutes.
You did it here today, this morning, 3 people took you up.
Oh, just over an hour?
Yeah.
And we weren't even working particularly hard.
No.
You know, it's not a difficult thing. And if I'd had 3 people, it would have taken me an hour or an hour and a half to tape it together.
Yeah.
If you imagine mass manufacture, it would be pretty easy. So the point that I'm making is that it's the reason it's worth looking at this as a starting point is it works from existing material supply chains. It's pretty simple, and it's not finished. It's not all the way to a commercial product. We haven't researched what materials are available in different parts of the world. We haven't gotten an NGO to pitch in and buy it, and we haven't gotten a company that's actually going to do commercial production. I got funding in 2007 from a company that came pretty close, and then there was the economic, actually 2008, and then there was the economic downturn, and they were like, we can't do this. We don't think it's going to work. So there's lots of room here, because it's an open design. Anybody could start a company to manufacture these things. Anybody could refine the design into something that was a product. Anybody could build off this to do something new. But it's a worked example of what happens if you say, well, what can we do with local materials? What can we do with stuff that's already in the supply chain? How do we work with the industrial base? What happens if we assume trucks rather than planes? And these are all, there are lots of ways of questioning these basic assumptions about the disaster relief tent to come up with new answers. The other thing, which is not apparent from this one, is the number one reason for using a hard panel rather than using a fabric skin is that you can put aluminum on the outside of the hard panel. You can take wallpaper paste and tin foil, or you can have it manufactured with an aluminum skin. What aluminum gets you is ultraviolet light resistance. If you put 100 microns of aluminum on the outside of this, the aluminum will not degrade in the sun, so you can make the shelter last essentially forever. And that was the real breakthrough. The reason we want to use hard-sided materials isn't just because it's better quality shelter, it's because you can make the outside reflective, which makes the building interior cooler, and it allows the building to last a long time exposed to the sun. And that was really kind of the big breakthrough. So it is just this thing of, you know, all it's one approach to all these fundamental questions. It's one approach to a different solution.
May I ask just...
Oh yeah, of course.
One?
Yeah, please, please.
I suppose you have heard or have something to do with shelter center sometime and their standards.
Yes.
How are your feelings towards them and your relationships? Because we have been reading them and trying to interpret them and talking to them, but What's your feelings about them?
Well, what the shelter center is looking for is a better tent. They've defined the tent as the solution, what they want is a better tent. So they originally started out looking to standardize the existing tent on something that everybody agreed would work. Because all of the NGOs and all the tent vendors produce slightly different tents. They're a bit bigger, they're a bit smaller, they're a bit higher, they're a bit lower. They're made of different kinds of canvas. And particularly they ship in different size boxes.
Mm.
So the first impulse of the shelter centre was, let's all agree on one common tent and we'll write a specification for that tent, and then anybody can manufacture them, and they'll be interchangeable units.
Because what you have made isn't somewhat contradictory to the standards.
It's a completely radically different approach. So what happened was that when people started to think together about trying to make an improved tent, somebody said, well, you know, what about things that aren't tents? What about hard-sided shelters? Or what about things like inflatable domes that you spray with concrete that would be good for long stay, transitional housing? And then it got into this much wider conversation about the nature of the shelter problem. So the shelter center program is torn between their initial desire to standardize the common disaster relief tent and all of this pressure to innovate in shelter from all these different angles. And the problem that they face is that innovation and standardization are two opposite forces. And you've got a single body which is responsible for both standardization and innovation. So that's your first problem. The second problem is that they're designing a shelter prototype and also managing a standards process. So that's a little bit like having Microsoft develop a word processor and then call it an international standard. They're going to define the standard to fit what they believe to be technically possible. And if I took the Hexier and defined it as an international standard for refugee shelter, there's no tent technology that could meet that specification, because you can't get that kind of thermal performance out of a building that doesn't have hard sides. You see what I'm saying? So there's a whole bunch of political contradictions inside of the shelter standardization process. And then on top of that, it's very, very, very hard to develop a set of standards that take a process which is already limited and then improve it. Right? We're already very close to the limit of capability of the tent as a format. That's why there's all this pressure behind transitional housing. So what I would like to have seen is two programs, one of which was an attempt to fully standardize the existing tent equipment that they're using and say, this is the tent, and then another program that said, how do we dissolve the line between tents and transitional housing? What are our options for our next generation sheltering system? And I think that if they separated those two programs out, it would be much easier to solve both problems successfully. But trying to run them inside of a single process is really, really difficult.
I guess if you follow them, you could never send down anything that's made of out of plywood, for example, because that would be too heavy and too big,
right?
Not possible to fly. And
that's
like
right.
That,
that's
so
right. But I mean, if you assume that you've got to fly your solution into the area, you've already taken out anything that uses local materials.
Absolutely, but they have.
But they have
a lot of things there, and
well,
we try to interpret them. And
I mean, if you
they are contradictory.
Uh huh. If you go through that list and you cross off everything which is an assumption that is tent centric, if you try and take it to a functional specification, where you say the shelter should have this much height and it should have this much weight and it should have these properties,
mm-hmm.
and you cross out everything that's specific to tents, you very quickly see that the standard is kind of complicated and a little incomplete. Personally, I think it's more important to look at the standard as a way of solving the problem, because right now there is no shelter which actually hits the standard. There's nothing that you can buy that actually meets the standard that they set down that I'm aware of. I don't think even their shelter module meets the standards. So at that point, it's only a question of, can you get kind of close to the standard, or can you explain clearly why not? Because if you can say, this section of the standard is inapplicable because this shelter is designed to be transported by truck and manufactured locally, then you can at least say that you understood the standard and chose to ignore that section. Does that make sense?
So it's more like you see it as a way of looking at it and not necessarily the way.
Oh, it's not the way. Even inside of the NGO world, nobody thinks of it as the way.
Yeah, well, because to us it's new, so to us it's like, okay, here you have the standards, and as well, do something that fits into this things like that.
It's not that kind of standard, right?
Okay.
The place to get that kind of information is really the sphere standards. Mm-hmm. The sphere standards are really fairly good from my perspective. I think they're a pretty well written standard.
So
and
they are more overall.
You know, 3.5 square meters per person for long stay storage.
Mm.
Or for storage, sorry. For long stay occupancy. You know, that's a functional standard.
Yeah.
You can kind of work from that. Sphere still kind of assumes you're going to line everything up in rows and you're going to have this much space. But there's at least a bunch of stuff there that's about real human factors. The shelter center stuff is pretty technical, but technically it's kind of incomplete. You know, it's really fundamentally, everybody knows that shelter center is a big, complicated committee process, and what's going to come out of it is a committee document. And committee documents typically take all of the innovation out at the beginning and wind up with something that's kind of very, very simple, basic, standard, this is kind of what we want. Everything that people disagreed about has been taken out. So don't think of that stuff as any kind of chain. It's a starting point from one research project that had political contradictions embedded in it at the beginning. You can get a lot of useful information about what people want, but there's nothing that meets the standard completely. You can get a lot of information about what works if you're going to fly it into the area, but maybe you don't want to fly it in.
Okay.
Right? The other thing is that it kind of assumes that you're going to be building one shelter per family. Well, what if you want to build an enormous shelter that's something like an inflatable stadium and house a whole bunch of people in that for the short term? If you're going to have a disaster situation where after a month people can go home again, maybe a big inflatable stadium is exactly what you need. And Netherlands Red Cross is very enthusiastic about that kind of stuff. They've got some researchers who are thinking through those kind of issues. None of that stuff's anywhere close to those standards.
No.
So yeah, I would think of it as a starting point for one specific kind of shelters, but it's by no means the full answer, and it's not for transitional shelter.
Oh, thank you very much. It was interesting to get your point of view.
Yeah. No, and I mean, always feel free to contact me. You know, you can send me questions, because I've got, you know, I've spent a few years banging my head against these walls, so I may be able to save you guys a little work on it. All right, where are we? Oh yeah, scalability. Do you have any more questions?
No, I'm fine right now. Thank
okay.
You.
If you think of anything else, interrupt me. So spike production we covered, IP, no patents. NGOs don't like patent technologies. They want things that they can use, they want things that are free and open source and all the rest of that stuff. If possible, try and stay away from patents. Ecological factors, secondary but real. Nobody really cares that much about whether you make your shelter out of plastic, but it'd be nice if you made it out of, you know, organic, recycled, whatever. You know, bamboo, for example, is a wonderful material. It'd all be nice use more bamboo. Would you mind opening those curtains? Because I have a feeling the video cameras might be not doing too well. It's kind of dark in here. If you open them a little, I think it'll make it bright enough to see, but not so bright. Yeah, that's probably good. You can still read the screen. Okay, so. So, all of the rest of the stuff, right? Infrastructure like toilets and sanitation, that's an integral part of the shelter solution. If you just put up the tents and you don't deal with that kind of stuff, you get waterborne disease. What are the opportunities for designing systems that meet all of those essential survival needs as a package? Not a lot of work's been done on that. The Hexier project was really the first thing to look at bundling that kind of stuff alongside. It's just the beginning. There's a whole set of things to do there. Agricultural self-sufficiency. Again, this doesn't apply in all areas. There are some places where people aren't going to regrow food because they're going to go back home in 3 months. There are other areas where they're simply not able to or allowed to restart farming. But in some situations, it'd be really interesting to have a fast start agriculture program where you put the shelters up and you ship them tools and seeds and know-how, and somehow you get agriculture restarted. I don't think there are any super easy answers to that, but boy, howdy, it'd be an interesting question. No? If we could actually figure out how to do fast start agriculture, there are a ton of situations where that would be very valuable. And I'm actually part of a distributed research project that's working on this. If you Google the phrase emergency permaculture, you'll find a bunch of our work. So disaster relief, local trades and skills. Again, you get a situation where the economy just gets wiped out because the tourists aren't coming anymore and all the hotels are destroyed. What do you need to provide to get people's local skills back in operation? Do you need to provide basic hand tools? Do you need to provide raw materials? You know, does it turn out that you need to ship in a bunch of sheet metal and some tools and people can then go back to producing what they made before? These are all kind of open questions, but it's worth thinking about, like, are there specific kinds of disasters where you can respond in a way that helps people get back on their feet economically? You know, one example of that might be things like bicycles. You know, it's a standard mode of transport all over the world. after disaster, if all their bicycles are gone, they can't return to their job delivering messages and all the rest of this kind of stuff. What happens if you start looking at putting the tools that people need to earn a livelihood back into the situation alongside shelter? Nobody knows. Refugee camps, you know, what would happen if you went out and you gave everybody in a refugee camp you know, basic tools for doing things like hair care, you know, like hair cutting tools? What if you gave them the things they needed to make clothes, you know, needles, thread, fabric? You know, what are the opportunities for helping people restart an internal economy inside of a camp? Do you have refugee camp dollars, which are only good for trade inside of the camp? Lots of opportunities there. Not very much work has been done on this. One of the guys who was one of the designers of the Euro, an economist called Bernard Leather, actually did a round of work on designing a currency for trade inside of refugee camps. Wow, you know, to return people to their productive occupations. Good work. Okay, technical solutions for social problems. Let me just define controversial. In Iraq, right, you've got this terrible problem that the US went in, blew up all of the infrastructure in the city, bombed the power grids, bombed the water stations, the whole thing. Then they're in a position where they can't rebuild that stuff because every time they try and rebuild it, somebody attacks the people trying to rebuild it or blows it up as a statement of Yankee go home. Now, it's a disaster. It's a disaster that all sides are contributing to maintaining. One of the things about that is that there have been three or four attempts inside of the Department of Defense to try and look at what happens if you use solar power and wind power as a way of getting the lights back on. If you go to each house in Iraq and you put a solar panel on the roof that they can use for interior light and recharging their phones and maybe watching television, then you're taking some of the social complexity out of the problem, because rather than having one agency owning the power grid, one agency guarding it, and one agency using it, so you get three sets of people who've got different goals, you've got one person who owns the power, guards the power, and uses the power, because it's their solar panel on their roof and they're in charge of it. And if that approach had been taken, it's very likely that most of Iraq would have much better electrical access than it does right now. And that's an example of a technical solution to a social problem. And over and over and over again, I think that it's possible to look at some of what's going on and say there are technical solutions for some social problems. Certainly not all of them, but some of them. And where possible, we should try and look for those opportunities, because goodness knows it's a lot easier than solving social problems at a social level. Okay, so let me change gear a little here. Two critical insights. This is the core pitch that I want to make. Taking things that are already in the global supply chain and turning it into the things that you need to survive is probably the right way to do this. If it's already being used in 100 million ton quantities around the world, it's probably safe to design with that as an input to your process, because it's always going to be around, the price is going to be stable, and there's a good chance they have it on the continent where your problem is. So saves on the stockpiling costs, gives you scalability, it's how we design the hex here. Things that might work that way: sodas water purification, where you put the water into the plastic bottles, leave it in the sun. I mean, we use gigatons of the necessary materials, it's plastic soda bottles. Some kinds of toilets, there's probably a lot of opportunity to design a toilet that's based on a 5-gallon plastic bucket that really effectively works. If not, there are lots of appropriate technology toilets that are really pretty decent. What would it take to package them in a way that you could do mass manufacture quickly? And I can give you some pointers on that if you're interested. What else can be done this way? There's a ton of essential services that we could be providing for people using stuff that's already common in the supply chain. What's the limit of that process? I don't know. But I really want to stress, you want to find stuff that's already being used on a huge scale globally and figure out how to quickly and effectively turn that into survival services. And remember that six ways to die model that we talked about back at the beginning? So that's a good map of what services people need to survive. And I think I'm going to go back and talk about that one more before we finish. Second insight. Disaster relief and development aid, at the end of the day, it's the same field. It's getting people back into a position where they're not rapidly dying of stuff. And, you know, thinking of it as a continuum of how do we take these people from where they are to a position where they can basically take care of themselves is, I think, a much better designed question Because in a developed world disaster, if you could put everything back the way it was before the disaster, things are now fine. In a developing world disaster, if you put everything back the way it was before the disaster, things are not fine. So you want to do better than restoring it to where it was. You want to figure out how to put it back into a position where you've got acceptable mortality rates. Political problems around this. Oh my God, the division between the disaster relief NGOs and the development NGOs is really huge. They don't work together very well. Governments are even worse. There's very little political union here. But that doesn't mean that that's not an accurate definition. This whole thing about poverty and resilience, you know, don't forget that. The reason that these people are so fragile is because they were already poor. They don't have backup. Disaster relief. Why is it an easy problem? There's a bunch of money, right? You can spend $20 to $50 to $100 per person involved in a disaster pretty easily because the West will fund. Small populations, you get a few million people affected, worst case, as opposed to poverty that's billions of people. World public opinion gets involved, you get the press, there's logistical and political support. Poverty is just massively, massively harder. But if you could get big progress in disaster relief, there's a pretty good chance that a lot of that stuff will also apply to poverty. There's a lot of opportunity there. Things that are pushing this situation forward. South-South cooperation, right? You know, the Chinese are doing infrastructure development in Africa. Well, they've got a very different approach from the colonial powers that went over there because they've been poor recently. They remember what it was like. Is it better? Is it worse? Is it good? Is it bad? Those are open questions. But it's done in a different style, and I think that's probably true for disaster relief too. ICT, we've talked about this, cell phones, GPS, SATCOM, SATMAPS. There's lots of new tools on the table that can be used to solve these problems. Interagency cooperation. Because we've got much more collaboration possible because of the internet, because of email, cheap international cell phones, lots of international meetings, agencies are getting better at working together. And that's a really, really important thing. The better these agencies get at cooperating, the more opportunity there is for fundamental change. And you know, things like the European Union spend a lot of money trying to get better international cooperation. Those are really things that we can support, things that we can work with. Finally, because there's so much more media and so much more ease of communication, we're beginning to expect better performance in disaster relief from the NGOs and the governments. The bottom line is that the American government's reputation will never really recover from Hurricane Katrina, because it was such a disaster and it was almost entirely caused by bureaucracy. People expect better than that, and they're going to put pressure on that situation. As you see people beginning to blog and send video out of refugee camps and out of disaster areas, you'll see much more pressure on the NGOs to perform better. And all of these factors contribute to pushing the state of the art beyond where it is now and into new territory. And as I said, this is not all, you know, this is not a problem that somebody else sat down and solved. This stuff is all wide open for people to get involved in and make a contribution to. So, timescales. Right, I invented the hex here in 2002. First test was 2003, and I spent about 10 days in one in the middle of a desert in 110 degree Fahrenheit, which is, what is that, 40 Celsius, something like that, 35 Celsius, 45. 40, yeah, with 60 mile an hour winds, dust storms, and I was there for about a week, and it was great, fantastic. So 2005, United States Department of Defense picked up the design and said, wow, this is really cool. I did a bunch of planning for using hexyurts to clean up after a nuclear bomb in America. If there was a nuclear blast, you'd have to rehouse something like 10 to 20 million people immediately afterwards. And you couldn't rehouse them in the general population because many of them would be radiologically contaminated. So, you know, emergency housing in that situation is a big deal. Okay, great. So now there's a Department of Defense testing program. 2007, 2008, I got talking to the Netherlands Red Cross. They said, this is very cool, we like this. Can we get some for testing? They got a testing program going. We're trying to arrange how to get them into that testing program. So, you know, that's 7 years from the point where the thing was invented and we still don't have a field test. It's a slow process because the bureaucracy on the other end of these situations has no money for development. they're just not allocating funds to this kind of stuff. Even the US Department of Defense was using these tiny little, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 slices of money that were left over from year-end budgets. It's not like there's a big pool of money waiting to pool these new ideas into the field. So opportunities like cooperation with, you know, SRA or any other NGO group that will talk to you, grab that stuff and work with them as much as possible, because otherwise it's a really, really slow process. If we did field tests for the hex year and it worked great, it might take 10 years before you saw 2 or 3 million people in them. It's a really, really slow field, but it is getting faster, and the internet in general is accelerating change in all areas. That's the good news, right? And finally, we can all actually help with this process. It's not an area that's dominated by an enormous number of skilled engineers who solved all these problems 20 years ago. It's not like trying to design a new aircraft, where there are huge companies that have got really top people working on this stuff all the time. My estimate is that there are less than 100 people globally who are full-time researchers into shelter issues. I think it's less than 100 people globally. Which is really kind of shocking when you think about it. You know, there are a lot of people who are involved in deploying shelter, but there are very few pure researchers. And most of those people start a company and then try and sell the shelter and then go bust because the NGOs take 5 years to buy one. So what comes out of that is the real opportunity here is for open source research, where one group picks up an idea, does some development work, publishes everything, doesn't have any patents, and then moves on to do something else. Another group can pick that work up and continue it for another cycle. And slowly, many, many different groups who each carry the task for 6 months or a year or 2 years can move it up this long, long, long chain of cause and effect until finally you get a new solution that's in the field. But it's going to take a different approach to the approach of start a company and immediately commercialize, because people have been trying that approach for years and it just doesn't work. You know, there are 2 or 3 little shelter companies. There's World Shelters, Global Village Shelters. There's a couple other little outfits that have really, really interesting shelter technologies. But they're just not making enough money to get by on, really. I don't remember, there's a dome company whose name is temporarily escaping me that actually survives and makes a living this way. But in general, it's not something where the existing development models work very well. But there's lots of room for open source style collaboration to make this stuff happen. And I think, is that the last slide? Yes, that's it. So I'm going to go back just close to the beginning to point out one more thing in a little more detail. So this model of, you know, too hot, too cold, hunger, thirst, illness and injury, individual, household, town, region and world. This model is really useful when you start trying to define systems, right? A shelter is primarily to protect you from the heat and the cold, and it's mainly household level. If you designed a shelter that was a municipal level shelter would be something like a big inflatable stadium you could put everybody into, because that can be like a town-sized solution, be beyond the individual family level. You know, cooking, you could have an individual level stove, you could have a regional stove, a town level stove, where you've got a big solar oven, and you put your food into the solar oven along with everybody else's, and you take it out and it's cooked. Some really interesting approaches like that. Same thing with water purification. Normally it's done at a municipal level. Sometimes you do it with a water filter, like a biosound filter at a household level. There's an outfit called Life Straw that I think is associated with a Swedish company. And they put water purification at an individual level because they give you this thing that you carry around your neck that you use to drink through, like a straw, Life Straw. So there's lots of room for thinking about these solutions in terms of sheltered infrastructure in a systematic way. What kind of threat to your bodily welfare is it protecting you from, and what's the level that it's operating at? Is it individual? Is it household? Is it beyond the house? Is it a regional solution? So this is a really useful model, and it's open source. It's called 6 Ways to Die, and if you punch that into Google, it'll come up with the PDFs. And if you need an editable file, I have one I can put up. But it's a good way of framing the problem. And beginning to talk about, for a specific shelter, what range of environments is it going to protect you against? If it's going to protect you against heat, is it going to protect you against cold? If so, how hot, how cold? You know, does it have any secondary benefits? If you make a hexier out of a very reflective material, one of the things you can do is put two hexiers together at the right angle, and it will make a gigantic solar cooker between the two reflective walls. Could be all kinds of applications for sterilizing food, for sterilizing water, for cooking. There's lots of ways that you could think about these products. So I think I'm done. It's on my notes. Questions? Ideas?
Can you show the email again?
Oh, yeah, sure. I have cards, too. And everybody, I mean, feel completely free to contact me, send me questions. You know, if you want me to review ideas, send me stuff and I can tell you what I think. Just, you know, be in touch.
Have you tried in a systematic way, instead of going through organizations, to building knowledge directly to the people, so to say, to send out building instructions?
Well, the instructions,
as a solution?
All of the instructions are online, so the Hexier how-to information is all fully public.
Yeah, but like something.
Right. The thing is that we haven't done enough field testing for me to be confident that it's not a bad idea. So I'm not personally ready to say to people in a disaster situation you should build Hexiers, because what if we missed something?
I was more thinking like in poor countries like shantytowns or.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At this point, again, we haven't done enough testing to really feel secure doing that. Because the last thing I want to do is go out there and promote a technology that people try and then it doesn't perform for them. You know? It's something where I would like to get, you know, really good, solid field tests done first. And then I could say, well, you know, if it's good enough for the Netherlands Red Cross to give it this report, that it's good enough for us to go to the developing world directly and say, hey, try building this. So it's this kind of balance of, I've made the information available. In America, I mean, hundreds of people are building hexyurts for recreational uses. They're building them for desert camping, they're building them for Burning Man, they're building them because they're hippies and they live in communes. I mean, really seriously, right? It's a technology that's actually getting used by people just downloading the plans and going. And there's no reason that couldn't begin to happen in the developing world, but I'm not going to go out and push it into the developing world until I've got much more of a really solid sense that we've been doing it for, you know, a long time under rigorous conditions and we've got some real test results. Now, could somebody go to some village in the developing world and do this stuff and see how it worked in a shanty town or in a village? And would that work as testing information? Absolutely. But there's a limit to how far I'm willing to do that personally, because at the end of the day, you know, am I going to have sound judgment given that it was my idea?
Has anybody done it?
Not yet, not yet. But there's lots of room for an independent group to do it and then tell me what happens. But I'm not willing to be the person who pushes on that because it's my idea and I'm not going to be objective. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, I really want that work to be done by people who are going to be critical about it rather than, you know, we went out there, we built some hexyurts and it's good enough. No, I want to see that stuff done formally. But in a few years, if we do some field testing and it all works and the NGOs are like, yeah, this is kind of a good idea, then it would make a lot of sense to try and develop indigenous capacity, particularly in areas with recurring disasters like like Bangladesh. You know, and a lot of the long-stay refugee camps in Africa, you know, those folks have been there 10, 20, 30, 50 years, not 50, actually maybe 50, some of them are really old. So in those situations, it would make a lot of sense to go out there and, you know, potentially to start trial programs, but again, you know, I really don't want to be in a situation where a hexier that wasn't built quite properly falls on somebody.
Because you're not
going to
stop anyone.
There's no way I can't stop anybody. I mean, I encourage people to build hexiers, but there's a difference between making it available and saying, give this a try, it's an experimental shelter design, and saying to people, we have a solution, go out and build our solution. Right now, I still regard it as an experimental technology, even though it seems to work great.
Yeah, but I mean, because there are a lot of, for example, yurt companies that manufacture yurts.
Mm-hmm.
They have a number of years of experience.
Yes.
So how do you compare yours to that?
Every indication I have is that a hex yurt is about 10% the price of a regular yurt.
Yeah, I mean, as a performance.
Oh, for performance? Well, I mean, a yurt is about $5,000, and a hex yurt, even with pretty advanced materials, is $500 to $1,000. A yurt needs professionals to make it, and it's about a ton of stuff. I mean, it's a lot, all the wood and the canvas and all the rest of it. A hex yurt, there's practically nothing you can make a hex yurt out of that two people can't carry. You know, it's really, really cheap, and it's really simple by comparison. Seems like it works great. And I think that I'm fairly sure this year that we'll see some commercial companies do small-scale manufacture for Burning Man. I think we're actually going to see that happen. Probably more than one, probably 5 or 6 little outfits where people will make them locally. But, you know, they have to deal with the liability issues, and they have to deal with the manufacturing issues, and they have to deal with the product safety stuff. Because if they're going to do this on a commercial basis, they've got to deal with that stuff. And it's a delicate line, you know? I keep telling people, look, you know, take 1 millimeter of aluminum, 15 centimeters of polystyrene, and then 1 millimeter of aluminum, seal the edges of the panel, and then build houses out of it. Right? Sounds like it makes sense. It'd be insulating, it would last forever, it'd be cheap, it'd be strong, you could build one-story dwellings out of that material. You couldn't go to 2 stories, but you could go to 1 story, and use the same material for the walls and for the roof. Now, does that make sense? Sure. If I tried to build houses that way, I would be arrested. So there's a need here to be, you know, careful about which responsibilities different groups take on because of the legal liability issues. And it's a disincentive to progress, but here we are.
We have to wrap up here.
Okay.
We continue tomorrow about talking about it. Because we have a report from the Chalmers.
Fabulous.
Okay, done. And we take like 50 minutes or so.
Okay.
And then you will see how they do and get feedback.
Okay.
As well.
Cool.
And I think you have a PC PowerPoint, right?
Yeah.
And you have a Macintosh.
Yeah.
How are they doing together?
Well, I can export this as a PDF. Or
yeah,
wait.
No,
oh, you mean you have it on your
computer?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it should work. I mean, do you have it on a keychain drive? Or
sure. But I don't know how compatible they are.
Oh, well.
PC and Mac.
How complicated?
Out,
is it a complicated presentation?
Well, it's not, and it's
and
not. We're afraid that pictures will move around.
I guess we could just plug it in and have a
look. Do you want to look at it and see how it is, or do you want to plug in your machine? Okay, well, in that case, we're just going to have to see how it works. Okay. So if you have any more questions, you can come up and ask me, and you know, while we're futzing with this.
We actually have some candies. I guess it's